Revelation class held at the Enfield Ecclesial Hall on the 21st of September 1976. Brother John Knowles, continuing with the subject, the position of the angel and how it is acquired. And the reading chosen for this night's study is from the prophecy of Isaiah, chapter 35.
A cordial welcome to all visiting brothers and sisters, and to introduce our consideration for this evening, brothers and sisters, which we are still considering, the position of the angel and how it is acquired. We'll ask our brother Roger Gore if he would come forward, please, to read unto us Isaiah chapter 35.
Reading from Isaiah chapter 35. The wilderness and the solitary place shall be glad for them, and the desert shall rejoice and blossom as the rose. It shall blossom abundantly and rejoice even with joy and singing. The glory of Lebanon shall be given unto it, the excellency of Carmel and Sharon. They shall see the glory of Yahweh and the excellency of our God. Strengthen ye the weak hands and confirm the feeble knees. Say to them that are of a fearful heart, be strong, fear not. Behold, your God will come with vengeance, even God with a recompense. He will come and save you. Then the eyes of the blind shall be opened, and the ears of the deaf shall be unstopped. Then shall the lame man leap as an hart, and the tongue of the dumb sing. For in the wilderness shall waters break out, and streams in the desert. And the parched ground shall become a pool, and the thirsty land springs of water. In the habitation of dragons, where each lay, shall be grass with reeds and rushes. And a highway shall be there, and a way, and it shall be called the way of holiness. The unclean shall not pass over it, but it shall be for those, the wayfaring men, though fools, shall not err therein. No lion shall be there, nor any ravenous beast shall go up thereon. It shall not be found there, but the redeemed shall walk there. And the ransomed of Yahweh shall return, and come to Zion with songs and everlasting joy upon their heads. They shall obtain joy and gladness, and sorrow and sighing shall flee away.
We are still considering, brothers and sisters, the portion of Revelation chapter 10, the position of the angel and how it is acquired. And if you've all been very good, you should now be conversant with pages 556 to 567 in the book of Eureka. And if you've been very, very good, you should now be very conversant with Eureka, volumes 1, 2 and 3. I'll now ask John to introduce this evening's study, the position of the angel and how it is acquired.
I won't address you as my dear brethren and sisters, but my good brethren and sisters tonight, assuming that everyone's been very good, as our chairman has suggested. I hope, in fact, brethren and sisters, you have been very good, because it is my intention this evening to cover the remainder of this section in Eureka. And to do that, I'm going to deal with the first few sentences fairly thoroughly, first few sentences from where we take it up, and also the last few pages. The section in between, I'm going to really skip over, hoping that you've read that. So that's my plan of action as at this stage. But before I even do that, I'd like to turn with you to the notes, particularly to the chart on page 112, and maybe to the relevant note on page 114 as well. What I want to say about the chart is this. This work of the rainbowed angel that Brother Thomas deals with in this section up to page 567 of volume 2 really only takes us to the time when the Lord Jesus Christ, in company with the saints, intervenes at the Battle of Armageddon. But don't let's lose sight of the fact that Revelation chapter 10 shows to us that this angel is going to stand with one foot on the sea and one foot on the earth. So as our note says on page 114, the third paragraph down, his right foot upon the sea and his left on the earth symbolically incorporates the complete work of the subjugation of the nations, including Armageddon and the overthrow of Rome and papal Europe. The sea represents the ten-horned dominion. We'll see this in further notes on chapter 13, verses 1 to 10, where it deals with the beast of the sea. And the earth refers to the two-horned dragon power in chapter 13, verses 11 to 18, speaking of the beast of the earth. So when we come to chapter 13, we'll see there is a beast of the sea and a beast of the earth. Now, this rainbowed angel is going to stand with one foot on the sea and one foot on the earth. Essentially, in this section of Eureka, Brother Thomas is only showing us how he comes to acquire the position of one foot on the sea. He doesn't go on to deal in any length with how he comes to get that foot on the earth. By which I would mean, in simpler language, simply this. If we were to look at it from the aspect of Israel, there is to be two stages in the regathering and the refining of Israel. Correct? One stage leads up to Armageddon, and that constitutes Judah, so that those Jewish people who are in the land at the moment will experience the work that we are dealing with in this section of Eureka. That is, when the rainbowed angel returns, turns to the area of Sinai, marches up into the Arab lands, then over into Egypt, and then up to Armageddon. As a result of the victory at Armageddon, the Lord will then have placed one foot upon the sea. What happens after that is that the Lord, having then been enthroned in Zion and reigning over the area promised to Abraham, because that will be the area which he will have subdued at that stage, he then issues the proclamations to the nations, particularly outlined in Revelation 14, which will then result in the regathering of the other half of Israel, styled the ten tribes, or Ephraim, or sometimes just Israel. And as a result of that, the beast of the earth will then be judged, allowing the Lord, or the rainbowed angel, to then have his foot on the sea and on the earth. Now, why I mention that is because in this particular section, Brother Thomas really only takes us up to Armageddon. He leaves the other part till later on. And what he does is this. He uses certain passages of Scripture, such as Isaiah 35 that we've read tonight, Isaiah chapter 11, and other passages of this nature, as relating to both the work in regard to Judah and Israel. So he sees a double application of many of these passages. And you remember in previous classes I said that his use of some of these passages in the mystery of the covenant of the Holy Land explained appeared to be clearer than his use of it here in Eureka. And I've come to the conclusion, and I realise I should have come to this conclusion years ago, but then again, we're not all that brilliant, I suppose. I've come to the conclusion that what Brother Thomas is seeing is that these passages rightly apply to the work which the Lord is going to do to Israel when he returns. But inasmuch as there are two stages in the regathering and the refining, the rejuvenating of Israel, naturally these passages must refer to both aspects of the work. So it's interesting to see how passages like Isaiah 35, Isaiah 11, and those one or two others, Psalm 110 and so forth, have this double application. Now, this evening, we're going to look at some passages which in the past I've always seen as applying to the work of Elijah after Armageddon, but of course can also apply to the first stage of the work of the rainbowed angel prior to Armageddon. So with that little bit of a forerunner, I hope you'll bear this in mind as we go through here, and if, for example, when we come to the top of page 557 and we see his use of Ezekiel chapter 20 there as applied to the work of the Lord prior to Armageddon, we will also appreciate that it will apply in an equal sense to to the work to be performed after Armageddon in the regathering of the rest of Israel. So what I'm saying in simple language is that Brother Thomas sees a double application of many passages. Like all passages of Scripture, it's very often easy to see it in one aspect of its fulfilment and not so easy in the other aspect. Well, that's going to be the exercise that we're going to have to try and engage in as individuals so that we can properly balance this out. Now, the reason I asked you to turn to the chart on page 112 is because we show here that the march of the rainbowed angel does not stop at the victory which the Lord has over Gog in the land of Israel. Because you'll notice, taking it up, say, from point number 21 on the chart, that virtually the first stage goes down to point 20. When we come to point 21, we're introduced to the millennial gospel being proclaimed after the Lord has established himself as king in Zion over the nation of Judah. Then there will be the combined nations. Then the combined nations will reject the ultimatum. There will be the judgment wars of destruction, Elijah's work of restoration, and the worldwide second exodus of Israel. And so then many of these passages which Brother Thomas is using here now to apply to the work before this time will then have another application as they see their extension into the second half of this particular work. If that's not altogether clear, I hope it will become clearer as we see the application of it, and it will save me trying to explain this double application in each incident or each instance as we come to it. And that, I think, also would cover some of the points that we've made in previous studies. Well, we're starting this evening from page 556, the first paragraph down, when the south is thus freed from the domination of the house of Esau. The page in the red edition, I haven't got it, 181 in volume 2B, which reminds me at this stage, we've got an advert in case I forget later on. If there is anybody who has been unable to get a copy of Eureka, if some perhaps new members have not got Eureka and you can't get it now, the red edition is available, and I understand the Cumberland Ecclesia have a number of copies of the red edition. The red edition is not exactly the same as this black one. It has been slightly edited. Just how drastically I wouldn't like to say, but it has been slightly edited, but certainly it's better than having none at all. I understand the black edition is completely unavailable. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I understand it's just absolutely unavailable, and it could well be that the red edition will not be available for that much longer either. So if you haven't got a copy of Eureka at all and still want to get some, probably we can negotiate to get some from Cumberland. That looks a new one. Is that a new one?
Yeah.
That's what reminds... Oh, New Zealand. Where's that? Which reminds me, we should have welcomed Sister Ascot from Australia tonight, shouldn't we? I thought you were returning home and you just visited New Zealand occasionally. Yes, very nice to have Sister Ascot here. She spends more time, I think, listening to the class in this hall than she does back on the tape in New Zealand. But anyway, it's nice to have her here. If there were any other visitors that I didn't pick up, to them too. All right, well, this is the point we want to deal with, this first quotation. When the south is thus freed from the domination of the house of Esau, Obadiah verses 18 to 21, the healing of Egypt will commence. Now, inasmuch as in the next few pages, we're going to get quite a few references to the territory of Edom, I thought it was appropriate and important that we have a look at this verse which Brother Thomas is quoting. Here is the land of Edom. We should be quite familiar with that by now. That's the land of Edom. It's called the land of Edom because it was settled in the first instance by a man by the name of Edom. Well, who was the man who was called Edom? Well, the man who was called Edom was Esau. Just a quick reference back to the book of Genesis will confirm this for us and also tell us why his name was called Edom. In Genesis chapter 25, we have the incident where when Esau came in from the field feeling very hungry, he pleaded with Jacob to feed him. And Jacob said, "All right, I'll feed you, providing you sell me your birthright." And the story is found particularly in Genesis 25, verses 29 to 34, which we shall read. And Jacob was boiling pottage, as the word sod means. He was boiling pottage. And Esau came from the field, and he was faint. And Esau said to Jacob, "Feed me, I pray thee, with that same red pottage, for I am faint." Therefore was his name called Edom. Well, a quick reading of that verse doesn't explain it for us very clearly, does it? Let's read it a little more accurately. Esau said to Jacob, "Feed me, I pray thee, with that same red," and the word pottage has been put in by the translators to try and make it a little easier. But in fact, as the margin helps us out, it says, "Feed me with that red." Pottage understood. So what Esau says is, "Give me that red stuff, thing, pottage, call it what you like." He emphasizes the word red. He repeats it twice. "Give me that red thing." As a matter of fact, that's the way that Young's literal translates it. Young's literal translation translates it. "Feed me with that red thing." Therefore was his name called Edom. Now the Hebrew word for red is the word Adom, A-D-O-M. Inasmuch as vowels in the Hebrew language don't change the basic meaning of the word, we see that the word Edom, E-D-O-M, is the same word in effect as Adom, which is A-D-O-M. And of course we can see the very closely related word Adam, A-D-A-M, all having the same root meaning of red. So because Esau came in from the field and demanded that red thing, that Adam, therefore was his name called Edom. Now, the territory of Edom and the nation of Edom derived their name from this particular man. So Jacob said, "Sell me this day thy birthright." And Esau said, "Behold, I am at the point to die, and what profit shall this birthright do to me?" And Jacob said, "Swear to me this day." And he swore unto him, and he sold his birthright unto Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau bread and pottage of lentils. These pottage of lentils are made from a plant bearing seeds resembling small beans. And so he rose up and went his way. So having eaten of this meal of these red lentils, these beans, he went away, having sold his birthright and also having his name changed from Esau to Edom. So later on we find the land of Edom, also called the land of Esau, or the house of Esau. It's also styled Mount Seir, because Mount Seir is one of the prominent landmarks in the territory. So whether we read of Esau, Edom, or Seir, these are in effect synonymous terms. Now to come over to the book of Obadiah then, and I'll try to avoid the temptation to engage in a dissertation at length on Obadiah. We do notice, however, in the opening verse of the book of Obadiah, that this very short book, which consists of only one chapter and 21 verses, is a prophecy directed against Edom. Obadiah verse 1. "The vision of Obadiah, thus saith the Lord Yahweh concerning Edom. We've heard a rumor or a report from Yahweh, and an ambassador is sent among the heathen. Arise ye, and let us rise up against her in battle. Behold, I have made thee small among the heathen, thou art greatly despised." And so the prophet Obadiah rose up to predict certain punishments which God was going to bring upon the nation of Edom. You see, what had happened at this stage was that as far as Esau was concerned, the history of the nation was such that when Jacob went down into Egypt, remember from the time when Joseph invited him to go down to Egypt, Esau went over and dwelt in the land of Seir. When the children of Israel marched up towards the promised land, as this map shows us, when they marched up here, they came to the borders of Edom. And this hatred between the Edomites, or between Esau and Jacob, had now come down to the descendants of these people. And you remember the Edomites would not allow them to pass through the land. So this hatred still continued down through the time. Later on, when the Jewish nation was taken captive by the Babylonians, The Psalms tell us that the Edomites assisted the Babylonians to cut off those that escaped. And so when the Jewish people fled from the city, the Edomites stood in the crossroads, it said, to cut off those of them that did escape. So subsequent history showed that the hatred between Esau and Jacob continued down through their descendants. And so, as the prophecy of Obadiah shows, it's because of Edom's hatred against Judah that God was going to judge the Edomites. So whilst Nebuchadnezzar had taken Judah away captive, Obadiah points out to Edom that Yahweh would use that same power to punish the Edomites. He speaks in these early verses about those men that sit down at the table and eat their bread with you. Take verse 7, for example. All the men of thy confederacy have brought thee even to the border. The men that were at peace with thee have deceived thee and prevailed against thee. They that eat thy bread have laid a wound under thee. There is none understanding in him. Shall I not in that day, saith Yahweh, even destroy the wise men out of Edom, and understanding out of the mount of Esau? See the parallelism there? Wise men out of Edom, and understanding out of the mount of Esau. So Edom and Esau are seen as parallel terms. And thy mighty men, O Teman, shall be dismayed, to the end that every one of the mount of Esau may be cut off by slaughter. So the Edomites as a nation were eventually cut off entirely. They weren't cut off entirely by Nebuchadnezzar. They were punished. But they did retain some people alive sufficient to allow the nation to continue. In later times, the name Edom came to be changed to Idumea. And so in the time of the Lord Jesus Christ, there were some Idumeans around, the most prominent family of which were the Herods. Herod was an Idumean. Herod was a descendant of Esau. And so this hatred between the Edomites and the Israelites still continued, in a sense, down to that time. Now, according to Josephus, it was the Idumeans who remained in the city of Jerusalem that caused so much of the trouble when the Romans came to take the city in AD 70. And as you know, the people did stop in the city, didn't they? Some of them fled early in the peace, but not the Edomites. They remained in the city, and they were the most fanatical of all. And when the city was destroyed, history testifies that that was the last that was ever heard of Edomites. They were all entirely cut off. There are no literal Edomites alive today. There is no nation which can claim to be the descendant of the Edomites. The Arab nations are not descendants of the Edomites. They are descendants of the Ishmaelites, maybe of the Philistines in some sense too. The Palestinians claim that they are descendants of Philistines, not descendants of Ishmaelites, but that's another argument. The Israelis insist on calling the Palestinians Arabs, and the Arabs insist on calling themselves Palestinians, and there's a slight little technical hitch there which most people don't catch up with. But be that as it may, there's no Edomites. There might be Philistines and there might be Arabs and Ishmaelites, but no Edomites. They've been cut off. But Obadiah goes on to speak about a latter day destruction of Edomites. So if there are no literal Edomites, what does the second half of the book of Obadiah refer to? Well, we come down then to where the second half of the book of Obadiah starts, and that's in verse 15. For the day of Yahweh is near upon all of the heathen, as thou hast done, that is, as you have done Edom, it shall be done unto thee. Thy reward shall return upon thine own head. For as you have drunk upon my holy mountain, so shall all the heathen drink continually. Yea, they shall drink, and they shall swallow down, and they shall be as though they had not been. So he says, what Edom as a nation did to Israel, that is, they hated Israel, so in the latter days other nations shall arise and manifest the same attitude. One nation, of course, in particular. Verse 17. But upon Mount Zion shall be deliverance, and there shall be holiness, and the house of Jacob shall possess their possessions. The house of Jacob shall be a fire, and the house of Joseph a flame, and the house of Esau for stubble. And they shall kindle in them and devour them, and there shall not be any remaining of the house of Esau, for Yahweh hath spoken it. And the south shall possess the mount of Esau, and the plain the Philistines. And they shall possess the fields of Ephraim, and the fields of Samaria, and Benjamin, and Gilead. And the captivity of this host of the children of Israel, that of the Canaanites, even unto Zarephath, and the captivity of Jerusalem, which is in Sepharad, shall possess the cities of the south. And saviours shall come up on Mount Zion to judge the Mount of Esau, and the kingdom shall be Yahweh's. Now these are the verses which Brother Thomas has quoted here in this section in Eureka. When he says, when the south is thus freed from the domination of the house of Esau, the healing of Egypt will commence. What then is the house of Esau that the south is to be freed from if there is no house of Esau still alive today? There is a territory of Edom today. I mean, Daniel chapter 11 speaks about Edom and Moab escaping out of his hand when the king of the north comes down. That's a territory, the ancient territory of Edom. But this isn't talking about a territory. This is talking about the house of Esau. So then, who are the latter-day Edomites? Who are the latter-day haters of Israel? Well, obviously, Ezekiel chapter 38 shows to us it will be the power of Gog. And that's exactly the way in which Brother Thomas uses it here. He speaks about the Russo-Assyrian Gog having been in Egypt in that previous paragraph. He speaks about the way in which they will have come down into Egypt. This almighty organisation having planted itself in Egypt. Oh no, that's talking of the rainbow angel, sorry. But earlier on he talks about the Russo-Assyrian Gog and the oppression which it has brought upon the land. You remember we've read it in the previous class. So this latter-day oppressor, this latter-day hater of Israel, is going to be the latter-day Edomite. In other words, the term Edom, used originally for the descendants of Esau, will be applied in the latter days to a nation manifesting the same characteristics. I know it sounds a bit of a joke, but of course it's not without significance that the Russians are also called Reds, which of course is what the word Edom, Adam, and Adam all mean. And for those of you who haven't heard the story about Obadiah before, there is one more word which is most significant in the completing of this story. If you turn back to Ezekiel chapter 35, you'll get the completion of this story. A very brief version of it, admittedly, but it does take us from the beginning to the end in some fairly quick steps. Here is another prophecy against Edom, and it's a latter-day prophecy, because it's in that section of Ezekiel which is known as the prophecies of the restoration. Ezekiel 33 to 39. Now Ezekiel 35 says, moreover, the word of Yahweh came unto me, saying, son of man, set thy face against Mount Seir. This was the mountain range of Edom. Seir and Esau, incidentally, are cognate words too in the Hebrew, Seir and Esau. And say unto it, thus saith the Lord Yahweh, behold, O Mount Seir, I am against thee, and I will stretch out mine hand against thee, and I will make thee most desolate. I will lay thy cities waste, and thou shalt be desolate, and thou shalt know that I am Yahweh. Because thou hast had a perpetual hatred, and hast shed the blood of the children of Israel by the force of the sword in the time of their calamity, in the time that their iniquity had an end, therefore, as I live, saith the Lord Yahweh, I will prepare thee unto blood, and blood shall pursue thee. Since thou hast not hated blood, even blood shall pursue thee. Now I think perhaps the easiest and the quickest way to illustrate this is with a little chart, which I'll just draw up here rather quickly and perhaps a little roughly, but it will illustrate the significance of this particular passage. We've said that there were three words up to this present stage which all have a similar meaning. Let's set the chart out in this fashion. Over this side we'll put the Hebrew. In the middle we'll put, let's do it nice and colourfully, the AV translation. And over in the third column, significantly in red, the basic meaning. Now down the left hand column We'll put the first word, which is E, D, O, M. Notice I've put the vowels in lower case so that the consonants stand out, because they are the important letters in the Hebrew. So we've got the word under the heading of Hebrew, we've got the word Edom. In the AV, that is translated by the word Edom. And the basic meaning of that word is red. See, the consonants D and M have the idea of red. The way in which it manifests itself, of course, will be slightly differently from case to case. The next word we come across is the word Adam. We were told the man was called Edom because he had asked for that Adam. See, the consonants are the same. And in the authorised version, it's translated as red, and the literal meaning is red. We find that Edom, or Esau, manifested the same characteristics as that man back in the beginning, who was created out of the red earth, and his name was Adam. In the authorised version, it is translated as either Adam or sometimes as man. It's the common word for man, and the literal meaning, basic meaning, is red. But there's one more word, and if you were following it very closely, that reading then of Ezekiel chapter 35, you would have seen a word which was emphasised very prominently in those last few verses. And what was that word? That's right, it was the word blood. And the word blood is the word dam, D-A-M, and its literal basic meaning is red. Now here is what we might style, and I'll put the heading down the bottom. No, I won't put room at the top. The parable of Edom. That's what we can call it. The parable of Edom. Now what is the parable of Edom? Esau came in from the field and he demanded that Adam. He was like his father Adam. He was a man of the flesh. And so because he manifested those same characteristics, his name was called Edom. So Esau said, give me that Adam. He was like Adam. They called him Edom. All of these things, of course, are represented here by the basic meaning of red, which symbolizes in the scripture sin. And for the parable to see its completion, it was necessary that the flesh must be sacrificed. The blood must be poured out. And therefore it is only with the shedding of the blood of Edom that Yahweh will see this story or this parable completed. Now, the significance of it is seen partly here in this reference in Ezekiel chapter 35, where we were told that in verse 6, therefore as I live, saith the Lord Yahweh, I will prepare thee unto blood, and blood shall pursue thee. Since thou hast not hated blood, even blood shall pursue thee. First of all, we notice it is a play upon the name Edom, but it is also a principle. We won't turn to it now, but you know in Ezekiel chapter 39 that after the destruction of Gog, we find that the nations are gathered to the sacrifice of Gog, and they are invited to drink the blood. They are invited to partake of this sacrifice. They are come along that ye may eat flesh and drink blood. So as we well know, the destruction of Gog is not just a destruction, it is a sacrifice. It is necessary that the blood must be shed, because Gog, as the latter-day Edomite, the latter-day hater of Israel, is the one who in the time of the end must have his blood shed, because he has not hated blood, as Ezekiel chapter 35 says. So very briefly, we've got this. We've got the literal descendants of Esau, who were called the Edomites, who were eventually wiped out in AD 70 by the Romans. Their blood was shed. Now in the time of the end, there will be the latter day Edomites, the latter day house of Esau. Not literal descendants of Esau, but a same power styled Gog in Ezekiel 38, who will likewise suffer the same consequences. Now, all of that was probably necessary, and perhaps even more so, I could have gone into it more so to explain that when Brother Thomas says, when the south is thus freed from the domination of the house of Esau, the healing of Egypt will commence, that what he is saying is that when the Lord, or when the rainbow angel moves into Egypt, he destroys the power of Gog there in Egypt. Because that's the latter-day house of Esau. You look puzzled, or does that sort of all start to click? Now, if you haven't studied Obadiah before, I realise I've gone through that fairly quickly. If you have studied it before, well, it was probably a bit of a refresher. But this is what he's saying. He's speaking about the smiting and the healing of Egypt. And when the rainbowed angel moves into Egypt, as he says here, it will be for the purpose of destroying the Gogian power in the land of Egypt. And it's not until the power of Gog in Egypt at this time, until that power has been humbled there, that of course the healing of Egypt can commence. So when the south is thus freed from the domination of, in inverted commas, the house of Esau, that is the latter day Edomite, Obadiah 18-21, the healing of Egypt will commence. Yahweh shall smite Egypt and heal it, and they shall return to Yahweh, and he shall be entreated of them and shall heal them. So
you're saying then that the smiting and healing of Egypt will not commence until Gog is fought. That's what you're saying.
But I'm saying the healing of Egypt won't start until Gog is fought. That's what Brother Thomas says. When the south is thus freed from the domination of the house of Esau, the healing of Egypt will commence. I wouldn't say that the smiting started at that stage.
So the smiting and the healing are not necessarily needed.
Oh, well, the healing follows the smiting.
Yes,
but the smiting would have started as a result of the oppression of Gog in Egypt. That would be part of the smiting, because they are going to cry unto Yahweh because of the oppressor. So I see the work of the oppressor in there as being part of the smiting. It's not just a smiting at the hand of the rainbowed angel. Yahweh would use, I think, the Gog being in there as part of the smiting. Pardon? Sorry, can't hear. I think the fierce king would start the smiting. I guess possibly the rainbowed angel could perform part of this work, but certainly it's the fierce king that is the oppressor there, and the rainbowed angel goes in to basically heal. So, yes, that's what I feel Brother Thomas is saying. But certainly in this section, he's talking about the freeing of the land as being the beginning of the healing process. Now, this is where we start doing a little bit of skipping. We're not going to read the rest of that paragraph. We have read many of these passages before because they come from Isaiah 19. He then speaks about Egypt being healed. But we want to get out of Egypt now as soon as we possibly can and on the way to the promised land. The next paragraph tells us that Egypt appears to occupy a very important position in the restoration of Israel by the rainbowed angel. Egypt, Cush, and Seba are appointed for their ransom. The wilderness and deserts of the south into which they are to be brought for discipline to fit them for settlement in the land of Israel. Ezekiel 20 verses 33 to 34. Now let's look at Ezekiel 20 verses 33 to 34. Here is a section of scripture which speaks about the gathering of Israel out into the wilderness. Now, in the mystery of the covenant of the Holy Land explained, Brother Thomas refers this to the work of Elijah after Armageddon. Here in Eureka, he applies it to the saving of Israel, those Jews who he says are in Egypt, those who are to be saved out of Egypt and brought up into the land prior to Armageddon. So, as I said, I think it's quite correct. There is a double application. I find it easier to see the second one, that is the one after Armageddon, but of course Ezekiel knows no such division, actually. Ezekiel chapter 20, and the particular section we'd be looking at would be from verse 33. As I live, saith the Lord Yahweh, surely with a mighty hand and with a stretched out arm and with fury poured out will I rule over you. And I will bring you out from the people and will gather you out of the countries wherein you are scattered, with a mighty hand and with a stretched out arm and with fury poured out, and I will bring you into the wilderness of the people, and there will I plead with you face to face. Now it's very easy to see how this will apply when after Armageddon, Elijah and those of the saints who are apportioned to the task, plus some of the refined third of Judah, will go forward to the nations, go out to the nations, gather Israel out of the nations, and bring them into what is styled the wilderness of the people. And for 40 years they will fight their way back to the land of Israel through the wilderness of the people. Verse 36 says that Yahweh will plead with them, like as I pleaded with your fathers in the wilderness of the land of Egypt, so will I plead with you, saith the Lord Yahweh, and I will cause you to pass under the rod, and I will bring you into the bond of the covenant, and I will purge out from among you the rebels and them that transgress against me. I will bring them forth out of the country where they sojourn, and they shall not enter into the land of Israel. And ye shall know that I am Yahweh. And so here in Ezekiel chapter 20, Brother Thomas suggests that as a result of the rainbowed angel marching into the land of Egypt, he delivers from the land of Egypt those Jews which have fled down into the land of Egypt because of the oppressor who is oppressing the land of Israel. That is Brother Thomas's suggestion, and we've previously commented on that in other classes. Well, because these Jews then that Brother Thomas has said will be down in Egypt have to be delivered, Ezekiel chapter 20 would seem to be applicable to the fact that they will be brought out into the wilderness. In this particular case, however, it would logically be the wilderness of Paran, as he goes on to show later on. So that having been delivered from the land of Egypt, they would come out into the wilderness of Paran, down here, and then come up into the land via that particular direction. So that's what Brother Thomas is going to expound at this stage. Having delivered them from Egypt, he's going to bring them up into the land. Now, let's just quickly gloss over some of these paragraphs, because we're nearly halfway in time and we're not halfway in pages. He says in this next paragraph, this is all part of the work of the rainbowed angel, in which Adon the Lord adds his hand to redeem a second time the remnant of his people which shall be left from Assyria and from Egypt and from Pathros and from Cush and from Elam and from Shinar and from Hamath and from the islands of the sea. Isaiah 11 verse 11. I think the emphasis should be on the statement, this is all part of the work of the rainbowed angel. And I would make part of the work of the rainbowed angel the deliverance of the people from Egypt. I don't think at this stage it is true to say that they are also going to be delivered from all of these other places, particularly the islands of the sea. That would seem to me to be part of the next step of the regathering after Armageddon. But you see, Isaiah and the prophets do not specifically divide up this work into two events. Most of the prophets see it as but one event, the regathering of Israel back into the land. It's only some prophets in some places that ever see fit to divide it. For example, Zechariah is one who does divide up these two aspects and says, I will save the tents of Judah first. And then he shows how he will make Judah his bow, and he will then fill that bow with Ephraim, or Israel, as the arrow. And he will fire this arrow, so that Judah, being those who are refined at Armageddon, will go forth as the actual implement, which is going to fire the weapon, and the weapon which will be fired amongst the nations will be those of Israel who are being regathered. So Zechariah does tend to speak of the two aspects of the work. He says, I will save the tents of Judah first. He speaks about making Judah his goodly horse in the battle. But most of the other prophets, like Isaiah and Ezekiel, see it as but one work. To illustrate this perhaps in a way that you can see much more clearly than this particular illustration, in Isaiah chapter 40, for example, Brother Thomas again uses this as an illustration of the particular point that I'm making in the book The Last Days of Judah's Commonwealth. He says, take Isaiah chapter 40, verses 3, 4, and 5. In these verses we read, the voice of him that crieth in the wilderness, prepare ye the way of Yahweh, make straight in the desert a highway for our God. Every valley shall be exalted, and every mountain and hill shall be made low. And the crooked shall be made straight, and the rough places plain. And the glory of Yahweh shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together, for the mouth of Yahweh hath spoken it. Brother Thomas's comment on that, and I entirely agree with his comment, in the last days of Judah's commonwealth is this, that those three verses speak of three manifestations of the Lord Jesus Christ. Verse 3 speaks of his first appearance. Verse 4 of his second appearance, and verse 5 of his third appearance. Which might sound a little bit unorthodox, but that's what Brother Thomas says. In other words, verse 3 is the proclamation of John the Baptist, prepare ye the way of the Lord, make straight in the desert a highway.